I studied secondary education, which means my... Yeah, right, secondary education, yeah!
We were really excited. The two of us were very excited about that, which means... So that means my college education ended in student teaching. So you may know, if you are around any teachers, if you're a teacher yourself, that student teaching can be a trial by fire. Anybody know any teachers? Yes, it is hard. So student teaching definitely was a trial by fire for me. It was one of the hardest 6 months of my life. Every single day, I felt like I was waking up to go to a place that I felt like I was a failure. That fills you with good feelings, doesn't it? Yeah, it was, I felt like a failure because student teaching is really hard and it's full of opportunities to fail. And I took a lot of those opportunities. But unfortunately, the way the two people who were most in charge of my experience, my cooperating teacher and then my supervisor from my university, the way they responded to my failures was one of the hardest things. It made me feel like I had to pay back my failures, make up for my failures. Sort of felt like they were demanding retribution from me. And so when I struggled in the classroom, I was not supported or given encouragement on how to do better, my struggles were just called out, and then I was told, you know, it's on me to improve. When I had a misunderstanding with another teacher at the school, I was not asked for my perspective on what happened. I was labeled flippant and disrespectful, and actually explicitly told that I would have to earn my way back into the good graces of my school and my university. That was one of the hardest things that I ever experienced, was that label being attached to me, and I was going to the same school every morning where it felt like I was a different person than I was everywhere else in my life. Even for something that was not my fault, I was told that I had to make up for it. So my university provided my supervisor, who's the person who does your observations for your university, they provided my supervisor with the wrong address for my school because unbeknownst to me and to my university, the school that I was at had changed addresses the summer before this school year. And so my first observation date comes and, you know, my supervisor has the address and so he's coming to show up and he's late. And when he arrives, I was confused, I don't know what's going on, but he's fuming upset when he arrives. And the reason is because he had the wrong address and he had to walk a lot more. He'd been like across the street where it had been in a previous building and then got out and had to get back in his car and park again and then come back in. And unfortunately, this was particularly a hard thing on him because he was actually a physically frail individual and walked with a walker. So I think that hit him extra hard. And he was just absolutely livid when he arrived. The first thing he says to me when we sit down for our observation for our meeting after my observation is that it's my fault for being careless about the school's address, and that if I wanted to be considered for his top recommendation, I would gonna have to prove to him that I wasn't careless. So there we go. There were so many things hard about that experience, that 6 months of student teaching, but I think it was being ruled by demands for retribution that was the hardest. That every time I experienced a failure, every time I experienced something not go my way, I had to pay back. I had to make up for it, prove myself. And partly, I think this was so hard because in many ways, I do think I was being treated unfairly. I do think that there were things that were not my fault that were put on me. There was nothing I could have done to earn my way back into good graces. But even just being in a situation where, like, yes, maybe theoretically there was a way that I could earn myself back in good graces, just being in that situation is horrible. You feel like a failure every single day, and then it's just compounded by that feeling. So it was in that season, that 6 months, that as hard as that was, it's actually that point in my life that is probably one of the top three moments of the most love I've ever experienced in my entire life. I wonder if that feels true for you, like the seasons of life where you felt the most broken down were also the seasons of life where you felt most love. Certainly does for this season of my life. So like, it was from my now wife, Kezia, whose apartment I ended up at crying most days after school. She was nearby, which was nice, down the street. From my three roommates at the time, who listened to me and just cared for me, and when I, you know, got home and was just feeling rotten, or when I was getting up in the morning and did not want to go to this stupid place that I hated. And then from one friend in particular, who I remember going on a long walk around my Rogers Park neighborhood with, and we just kept on walking the same blocks over and over again, and he just relentlessly affirmed me for who I was. Do you know what I mean by relentlessly? Like, when you are in a stretch of feeling like a failure every single day, it starts to affect your sense of self. When you're living in a world where you can't settle the score, you can't stop it from affecting how you think about yourself. And this friend was just relentless, telling me, I'm proud of you. I see the man you are. I see what you're trying to do. I see a person of character and integrity, even if your school and university doesn't. I know who you are. Listen to me, not to all of that. He prayed for me in a way that made me feel close to God. That was something that was really hard when I was feeling so down, like praying on my own. There wasn't much going on there. Just kind of trying to do it, but not getting much out of it. So this friend and my now wife, Kezia, and my roommates, they loved me when I had not done anything to earn it or deserve it. They loved me when I was a mess and I had nothing to offer in return. And they loved me to the point that it didn't feel like I had to make up for the failures to feel okay. Like, I was okay even if I didn't make up for this. Does this feel familiar to anyone? Maybe you're not a student teacher, but many of us have had these experiences. Or maybe the hard thing is you want it to feel familiar because you've experienced the down thing, but maybe never got that love. We never got that counter message. Love is a really different response to failure than demanding retribution. It's really different. And love opened me up to find God in the midst of one of the most horrible 6 months of my life, and to eventually be transformed by those failures, to not be shut down by them or ruined by them. And I think the key thing is that love begets more love. Like, do you know who I just have, like, immediate, large quantities of compassion for? Teachers. I just immediately have it. I don't need to look for it. I don't need to, like, try and, like, man, what is your life like? Because it seems really easy to me. Like, no, I'm ready. I have all, especially student teachers. Like, I'm just ready to, please tell me how you're doing. Seriously, how are you doing? Are you okay? Love begets more love. And yeah, it's a beautiful thing. So the hard reality, though, is that I think that it feels to me that American life is just, like, full of retribution, though, right? Doesn't it feel like American life is, like, by definition, retributive? You do something wrong, you got to make up for it. If somebody else does you wrong, you have the right for compensation, you know, to demand it. It's everywhere. I mean, and while love begets more love, doesn't retribution beget more retribution, right? Like, when it is demanded that we settle some score and then those demands weigh us down, life can feel so unstable, and inevitably, like, we latch on to whatever control, whatever power we can find, and we start to turn and demand retribution from those whose score we're in charge of. Like, do you know it was really hard for me not to do those 6 months of student teaching? Was to demand retribution of the only ones in my equation who I did have power over, the students. So hard not to do that, because retribution begets more retribution. So I think the consequences of this, like, this is like a mindset that's behind a lot of life in our world. It's pretty far-reaching. Like, most notably, I think it's how we think about justice, right? How we think about justice in this country is the very definition of retributive. It is, you were bad and therefore you're going to jail. Jail is not rehabilitative in this country. No, it's punitive. It's punishment. It's not about growth or change. And so, you know, interestingly, I don't think it's just the powers that be that I think we all are, maybe even if we, like, we hear this and we think, oh yeah, that feels true and that feels icky to me. The problem is that we still all talk this way. We still all, like, learned to talk about justice this way. when we say things like, I want justice, or it's not fair, what that means is I suffered and now I want someone else to suffer because I suffered. Right? Tit for tat. Somebody's got to make up for it. This is called a retributive understanding of justice. Retributive justice. We all kind of believe this. It's not actually a new mindset. So, but retributive justice is all over the social and religious models of today. It's been all over the social and religious mindsets of many cultures over the course of history. It was absolutely in the religious and social traditions that Jesus came from. So he has, actually one of his most memorable lines is a critical response to a retributive mindset, retributive justice. And you'll probably recognize it. He said, you have heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but I say, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. Turn the other cheek, right? We've all heard this before. Yeah. This is Jesus literally taking on a retributive mindset. This brings me to another consequence, I think, of this mindset being in us. How we think not just about justice in general, but how we think about divine justice, how we think about God. So throughout Lent here at Brown Lead Vineyard today, as Kyle mentioned, is the final Sunday of Lent, Palm Sunday, as we enter into Holy Week. We have been spending our Sundays together reflecting on what is coming on Good Friday, Jesus' death on the cross. That's what we remember. And the message that so many of us have absorbed about what Jesus' death on the cross is about is a message of retributive justice. Jesus' death fulfills some sort of punishment or violence quota that God needed to love us. There was some sort of requirement, and God filled it, or Jesus filled it, and now he can love us because the retribution was paid. We've absorbed that. That's how we think about God. Those of us who spent time in churches all of our lives, those of us who've just, like, in a passing way interacted with churches because we grew up in America, like, yeah, most everybody thinks if this Jesus thing is a thing, it's retributive. But the question I'm asking, and we've been asking various questions like this throughout Lent here, is how does that square with Jesus, the God of turn the other cheek? Right? If Jesus like took on an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and said, no, I teach you turn the other cheek, well, isn't that interesting? So how can we believe in a retributive God when Jesus is saying turn the other cheek? I personally don't think we can. But throughout history, we human beings, we project our I want someone else to suffer because I suffered feelings onto God. We do this so much because it's so strong in us when we feel wronged, when we feel unjustly treated or unfairly treated. The only way it feels like we can respond to that is to balance the scales. And so we often say here at Brown Line Vineyard, Jesus' death on the cross is about humanity's demand for retribution and punishment and violence, not God's demand for those things. In Jesus' day, the Roman Empire condemned him as a revolutionary, and the religious elite in his tradition condemned him as a heretic. And in response, Jesus practiced what he preached. He turned the other cheek. He chooses to be the victim rather than make another victim out of someone else. Even those doing him harm. One of the most famous statements from Holy Week, Jesus on the cross, and he says, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing. He refuses to make a victim even out of those making him a victim. Jesus chooses self-sacrifice to break the cycle of retribution, begetting more retribution, begetting more retribution, begetting more retribution. He cuts it off, refuses to play that game. Because retribution and violence, like, they can't redeem anything. They can't fix anything. They can't move people forward. They can't move society forward. That feels true, right? Doesn't it feel obvious when I tell my story about student teaching? Like, it's just, oh my gosh, Vince, that sounds like it was just laid thick upon you, and there's no way that you were going to be able to get out of that. Of course, like, of course love is redemptive, not retribution, right? Of course. When has a war to accomplish peace ever worked? And yet we drink that Kool-Aid, don't we? When is making sure that someone else suffers because you suffered ever worked? But we do that. I suffered, and I need somebody else to suffer to make me feel better. We do that. But it doesn't work. Retribution cannot restore balance. It can't move things forward. It can't bring peace. It can't lead to positive transformation. It can't lead to growth in a person or in a society. Only love can do those things. And my experience has taught me that, like, yeah, love can do those things. Everything we've learned about human behavior from psychologists confirms this too. Love, not fear of reprisal or fear of punishment, is what changes people, is what helps people move and grow and become all they're meant to be. So when I read the Bible, I wonder if this is true for you. Here's a hard thing if you've ever opened up the Bible. There are lots of things that seem to me to paint a picture of a retributive God, of an eye for an eye God. Has anyone ever experienced that, looking at something in the Bible? This kind of seems like eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Like, so the book of Ezekiel, for example, this is just one example I'm grabbing. Old Testament prophet, and it's basically chapter after chapter of courtroom imagery in which God is portrayed as an angry judge sentencing the ancient Israelites to punishment for their crimes, and their punishment is usually death. That is, like, you read that is hard. It is very uncomfortable if you've ever sat down to read. Things like that can make us want to toss the Bible out as an ancient relic of a crueler time and, you know, just kind of be done with it. Like, people believed cruel things about God and about the universe. Let's just set it aside. And if that is where you're at, I totally get that. Totally get it. Because it's uncomfortable to read. But what I've personally discovered is that if I stay with the biblical writers, an incredible thing happens. If I stay with them, they seem to again and again work through all of that anger, all of that demand for retribution. And then suddenly, again and again this happens. It's really incredible. Suddenly, they seem to experience an interruption to the retributive mindset, to the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth mindset. And leaping into these prophets, for example, like in Ezekiel, leaping into these prophets' pictures of God is this, like, love suddenly, these promises of love, promises of a different kind of justice, of redemptive justice, not retributive justice. Just leaps into their picture, and you're like, where did that come from? This suddenly interrupted by something that's beautiful and powerful and makes my heart sing. Ezekiel has one of the most famous. So it's in the midst, again, of all of this, like, courtroom imagery, sentences of punishment. And then we get this in Ezekiel 36. I, God, will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Then you will live in the land I gave you, your ancestors. You will be my people, and I will be your God. I love this, the bit about, like, a new heart and a new spirit God giving us will move us to do these things. That feels like the whole love begetting love thing. It's not like you are being moved to do these things. But just to step back and consider, this is just one example of how again and again, when we read the scriptures, promises of love interrupt demands for retribution. That happens again and again and again. And in a strange way, that actually makes the Bible feel more relatable to me than if it was just a neat and tidy bullet point list about God without narrative, without human emotion, without any element of any of that stuff. Because I think about how badly I wanted to let my student teacher supervisor and my cooperating teacher have it. I think about how badly I just wanted them to get what was coming to them. Because, oh, I'm about to curse on the mic. I'm not going to curse on the mic because this goes out on podcast and that would be inappropriate. I wanted them to get what was coming so badly for all they had put me through. Who among us can like immediately discard these kind of feelings when you're wronged? When you've experienced failure and then the response to you has been something cold. Can you just like, oh, you don't feel that? No, none of us. We all go there. It is so normal to go there. And it is profoundly comfortable to me that the book that I learn about Jesus through goes there too. It's not neat. It's not tidy. It has all of the elements of the messiness of my own narrative, of my own life. But yeah, we all need love to interrupt our demands for retribution. That's what it means to be alive. Love has to interrupt us. It's the only thing powerful enough to just like have that leap into your picture, to rewire your circuitry. Feeling loved when we haven't earned it and don't deserve it, when we haven't anything to give in return because we're such a mess. Feeling loved to such a powerful degree that you no longer feel like you have to make up for that failure to be okay. You actually are okay, even if the failure remains unpaid for. That is a level of love that changes you when you feel it. This is how I found God in the middle of 6 of the hardest months of my life. And this is how retribution didn't beget more retribution for me. Instead, the other cycle started. Love begat more love. That's how I got out of that and into the other side. I was opened up to move on from and learn from my failures and not be shut down by them. This whole story is a pillar now for me when it comes to the picture of God that I have formed. You know, what a horrible stretch in my life that I hate to go back to. It was like painful writing for this week because I did go back to these like negative emotions. But now, even this story full of negative emotions and negative memories for me and like, oh God, I don't even want to talk about that, let alone bring it to a bunch of people on a Sunday morning on a microphone. But even that story is now a pillar for me in the picture of God that I have formed. God is love and not retribution. And I saw it so clearly in that experience because I experienced retribution and it sucked and it kept me where I was and it tempted me to keep going and keep the cycle moving, more retribution. And then love interrupted and suddenly I was out of that. It's the only thing powerful enough to move me out. And even more like, God is self-sacrificial love. That's what we're looking at during Lent. Self-sacrificial love. Turn the other cheek, not eye for an eye. God would rather enter into my suffering and become a victim with me than see me suffer alone. God would rather enter into your suffering and become a victim with you than see you suffer alone. The power in that is that it doesn't feel right. All of the Psalms, one of my favorite prayers from the Psalms is, who am I, God, a mere mortal that you consider me, that you take care of me, that you dote on me? It doesn't feel right. Like God should be this distant, cold figure that's away and throwing lightning bolts from the, like that's what our brain wires us to think. And yet Jesus like interrupts that and says, no, I'm doing something totally different. It's the power is that it doesn't feel right. And so if there's like some like, yeah, maybe for somebody else, but not for me. Like, that's exactly why it's so powerful, because it is for you. God would rather enter into our suffering, our worst experiences, and suffer with us, next to us, than leave us suffer alone. That's the message of Jesus. And so I would love to pray for us in this place. I can think of a couple of things that might be stirring in some people if I can pray. So first thing that I might bring up, if you feel yourself captured in this as I pray, is if you are currently, or maybe not even currently, but if you have ever been in the midst of a situation like I'm sharing about today, weighed down by the demands of retribution, maybe you experienced failure, and the way people responded to that was, you got to make up for that failure. And so maybe you are feeling the temptation to let that flow through you to somebody else. If that's you, my goodness, you are not a bad person. You are so normal. You are so human. The only thing that can free you from that is love. It's the only thing powerful enough. And so if that's somewhere where you are, I want to pray for you to experience some of that today. I think that you can experience that directly from God. That's some of the power that can happen in prayer. Sometimes what it means is that you experience it through another person. God brings that love to you, as I experienced, through friends and through roommates. And so that can be a powerful thing. So I want to pray for us if that feels true for us. And then second, If you've been taught that, like, God is retributive, like we were talking about, if you've been taught that God is actually, he's a kind of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth God, you are not alone. A lot of people have had that image of God shaped in them. And it is hard to, like, you can't just, like, a light switch flip to something else. But what can change you is being interrupted by love. And that can slowly, like, if it's not a light switch, it's like one of the, does anybody watch Lost? Anybody like Lost? Yeah? Yeah, Lost? Woo! Yeah, Lost was awesome. Do you guys remember the big, like, wheel that you had to turn to, like, and I don't even remember what the wheel did. That show was really convoluted. But it was, there was, like, a big wheel that you had, like, lots of people had to turn. And it did. Anyway, this is a really long, drawn-out analogy to say, it's not a light switch to change our image of what God is like. It's more like that wheel. But that wheel can move, I think, this morning. I think that that's a promise that's available to us. And so if in some way you feel captured in that sense of, like, I think I believe in a retributive God, and it's not serving me, because it's not. It is never going to serve you. Retribution will only beget more retribution. But if you feel like, yes, I would like my picture of God to be God is love, that can do something different for you. I want to pray for you in that place. So with all of that said, can I ask you guys to stand with me, and I'm going to pray for us. Well, you can close your eyes or open your eyes, whatever helps you to feel comfortable. I'm going to pray for us. So for any of us here who do feel weighed down by demands for us to settle some score right now, we're living in that retributive world and we cannot get out of it. If that is you, I just, like, in your sort of mind's eye, you know, kind of raise your hand. You don't have to put yourself out right now, but just kind of acknowledge that, yeah, yes, that's me. I'm going to receive this prayer, and let me pray for you. Jesus, I ask that you would bring a love that can be felt right now to interrupt that loop that's playing. You have to make up for this, or you have to pay this back, or you're not worth anything until you've proved to the world or prove to some individual person or some group of people differently. All of that is just, pardon my French, bullshit. And so, God, interrupt that. Come like Jesus, who said, turn the other cheek and not eye for an eye. There is no eye for an eye here. There is no tooth for a tooth here. And I pray, Jesus, you would do that kind of like relentlessly affirming us thing right now. I see who you are. I see the character you're trying to live with. I see the integrity you're trying to live with. Even if it is not seen by everybody, I see you. And you are worthwhile and you are okay. And you do not have to prove anything to be free from the way this failure weighs you down, or the way this disappointment weighs you down, or the way this crappiness weighs you down, the way this hurt or this tragedy weighs you down. You can move on from this. Whatever it looks like for those of us who are like, we want to receive, or we need to receive that, I pray that you'd continue to speak, God, as we're singing together, as we're in this time of prayer, that you would relentlessly affirm us. And then I do also pray for any of us who feel like our image of God does feel a little bit like retributive sometimes. Like we're not sure. I don't know. Because sometimes God does feel like he wants to throw a lightning bolt at me because I did bad. And I pray that you would interrupt that. That you would, in that way that all of us need, that love would interrupt our retributive mindset. Show us what you're really like this morning.